2 full days at a retreat in Aspen in July, attended by Wells, Bourguignon, Burke, other top executives, and Sid Bass. The first step was to illustrate what had gone wrong, which, simply put, was the massive overspending undertaken largely at Eisner's behest. Murphy and his team prepared charts that compared the initial budget to actual costs, which were more than $1 billion over the original pro formas, and the consequences for debt service and operating margins. Bourguignon and Burke added their pessimistic views. They'd decided they had to be brutally honest or risk losing their jobs when the weak numbers came in. As the meeting progressed, Eisner became visibly angry. It was the first time anyone in the company had so directly criticized something for which he was responsible. Finally, he burst out, practically shouting, "I don't understand this. The pro forma said we could spend this." It was true the pro formas had been revised upward every time Eisner indicated he wanted to spend more. "That's because people told you what you wanted to hear," Murphy said. It was the first time anyone could remember Eisner raising his voice in front of Sid Bass. Murphy and Nanula outlined a drastic set of remedies: cutting the price of admission, hotel rates, food, and merchandise, slashing operating costs by firing 1,000 employees, and restructuring management. Even then, the debt would have to be restructured or, Murphy projected, Euro Disney would lose several hundred million dollars a year in 1994 and 1995. When Murphy finished, everyone turned anxiously to Eisner, who looked sullen and withdrawn. He made it perfectly clear to everyone trying to speak the truth that it was unwelcome, recalls one executive at the meeting. Despite his claims to Katzenberg that he always wanted to be the first to hear about problems, Eisner did not like to be told bad news, nor was he used to it. He had presided over a nearly unbroken string of successes, largely by acting on his creative impulses. In many ways, Euro Disney had been the grandest of these. From the beginning, it seemed as if Eisner craved critical acceptance and approval by the Europeans, which was the main factor driving the expensive quest for perfection in building the park. Still, the consequences of doing nothing were worse than the proposed remedy. Eisner reluctantly agreed that the second park would have to be put on hold, and told Burke and Bourguignon to return to Paris and drastically cut costs. Although Eisner later called this decision a bitter pill to swallow and distressing, he nonetheless demonstrated a characteristic sense of optimism even in the face of dire projections. As he put it, "There was never a single moment, including that moment, when I lost faith in Euro Disney. We still had a great park at a great location. We faced a business crisis, a blazing one at that. But I'd faced similar crises, albeit on smaller scales, nearly every week for 30 years. Although others at our meeting probably would have disagreed, my main feeling as we ended was one of optimism." Be that as it may, it didn't stop Eisner from casting blame for the Euro Disney fiasco on others. Gary Wilson and Frank Wells came in for the brunt of the criticism, Wilson for pushing for so many hotel rooms and for taking on so much debt, and Wells for the optimistic pro formas based on Disney World numbers. Wilson, of course, was conveniently gone, though still on the board. Judson Green replaced Richard Nunes as theme park chairman. Most strikingly, Euro Disney appeared to